Thanks for coming. Tonight's class. Before we begin tonight's class, I'd like to invite everyone to come join us the next three Wednesdays. Very exciting. We're having our long-awaited series, The History of the Kabbalists, from Reb Shimon Bar Yochai to the Arizal. Rabbi Abraham Lieberman, he's been here in the summer. He did the history of the Batei Migdash, of the Beis HaMikdash, of the three temples. And it was an extraordinary series of classes. And I am very excited about this. Usually, even though these classes will be on our website, but he does use lots of visuals. So it is it would be better for those who can come and attend the classes. It's beginning this Wednesday at 8 p.m., December 11th, next week Wednesday, the 18th, and then the 25th on Wednesday. It's going to be really good, so please come. And tell your friends, tell everyone about this. The shiur this week was dedicated by my good friend Monroe Sternlieb and his sister, Charlotte Weiss. And this is in honor of their father's yard site that is coming up this Friday on Asara B'Tevis, on the fast day, on the 10th of Tevis. Hopefully we will not fast on Friday, Ezras Hashem. His father's name is Menachem Mendel ben Yaakov. May his neshama be elevated in the merit of the shir to the greatest of heights and channel lots of blessings to you and to your family in everything, both in the physical and the material. This is also in honor of Monroe's son's birthday, Max Sternlieb, Menachem Mendel, whose birthday is English birthday is tonight. His Hebrew birthday must be one of these days. May he have a Shnas Bracha Natzlacha, a wonderful good year, a lot of growth. He should grow in Torah and Yirat Shamayim and have a very, very, very successful year in all of his endeavors. And lots of nachas. Another dedication tonight was by Mrs. Miriam Diller, and this is in honor of a late husband, Stanley Diller. His yard site is also going to be this Friday. His name is Shmuel Zanvil ben Aaron Yaakov. May his neshama be elevated to incredible heights. He's been so essential to Mayon Yisrael. He was one of the founders of the center, and I thank him again for that, and may the schusim of all that comes out of here continue to carry his neshama, and all the other tzedakah and chesed that he did in the world and goodness that he did carry his neshama to very, very, very high places, and lots of bracha to him, and a lot of bracha to you, Miriam, in everything that you need. Also in honor, she's also doing it in honor of her grandmother's yard site, which is tonight, the 7th of Tevis, Chana Bas Yaakov. May her neshama be elevated to the greatest of heights, and lots of bracha to you. Thanks for all those who dedicated. The CD this week has not yet been dedicated, and it is very, very helpful when they are dedicated, when they are sponsored. It's very helpful to the center, and it enables us to continue our holy work. So if anybody would like to do a sponsorship, or at least a partial sponsorship, even if it's when you're listening to the CD later in the week or after the class tonight, please come and let me know. It is a great schus. There's over 500 people that drive the streets that are when they're shopping, doing their whatever they're doing all about town, are listening to Torah and are being inspired. So it's a very great merit. 500 hours. Imagine that. 500 hours of Torah study. And you can have the merit of all of that. So please let me know if you'd like to sponsor. Tonight is, this week's parsha is Parsha's Vayechi. We're concluding the first book of the Torah. This week is the last parsha of Sefer Bereishis, Shabbos Chazak. And there's so much in the parsha. One of the highlights of the parsha are the blessings of Yaakov. Yaakov is coming close to his conclusion of his life. He knows that he can feel his energy is sapping and he's leaving the world. And he calls his sons together, like we find Yitzchak did before he passed away. Avram blesses his children, and Yaakov is going to bless his family before his passing. And so the brothers all line up to receive the blessing, and they step and they approach one by one. The first one to step up is the oldest son, Reuven. He steps up to receive his blessing, and ouch, there is no blessing coming from Yaakov. There is a stinging rebuke. Very, very, and it really hurts. You really, when you read the psukim, you really, I can't help, I'm sure many, we can't help feeling really, really bad for Reuven. Reuven gets whacked by Yaakov, but really hard. There isn't even the slightest bit of a blessing. All there is a harsh rebuke. Yaakov is chastising him for something that Reuven did in a moment of haste, in a moment when he lost himself for a good reason. He was upset for his mother's honor. He felt that his mother's honor was slighted by his father. And he, in a haste, did something he shouldn't have done. What does he do? The Torah says a few weeks ago in the parsha that Reuven, Vayishkaf Reuven as Bila, Pelegesh Aviv, that Reuven simply, it would seem to imply, had intimate relationships with Bila, the wife of Yaakov, the concubine of Yaakov, but the sages tell us that we, when that's not what it's, that even though it implies that, that's not what happened. Nothing close to that, chas v'shalom, God forbid. But rather that Reuven, after Rachel died, Yaakov has four wives. And even though he lived with all of them, and he had children with all of them, but his primary residence was with Rachel. And that's where he kept his bed in her quarters or in her tent. When Rachel passed away, she passed away the youngest, the first of all of them. So Yaakov moved his bed to the tent of Bila, who was the maidservant of Rachel. And I guess continuing to show his endearment, his affection to Rachel, and putting, if Rachel is not here, then I'm going to Rachel's maid. And that, in Reuven's eyes, was very, very insulting to his mother. I mean, Leah, after all, was Rachel's sister. She's not a maid. She's the one that Yaakov married first. She's the one who bore him, who gave him seven children. So Reuven felt that this was very disrespectful or insulting to his mother. That if Rachel, okay, Mela, Rachel comes first. He understood. Rachel was the love of Yaakov's life. For her, he went down to work to love, and this is the one he initially wanted to marry. Leah sneaked her way in. We can understand that. Rachel comes first. But Bila, who is she to come before my mother, Rebbitzin Leah? Chas v'shalom. This can't be. So he went and he moved the bed. He went out asking, instead of talking to his father, he just, in a rage, went into Bila's tent, picked up Yaakov's bed, and moved it to Leah's tent.
He caused some disruption in the divine presence of the Shekhinah, because God rests on Yaakov's bed. Obviously, Yaakov, who is a great Kabbalist and a great mystic and a great saint, knows exactly where his bed needs to be, in which position. We know that the holy Baal Shem Tov one time asked a person and he lived very, very long, close to 100 years old. And they asked him, like, what's your secret for longevity? And he said that when I was a young man, I was working around, it was like the janitor in the Baal Shem Tov's quarter, and I moved the Baal Shem Tov's slippers. They were sitting in one place, and I moved it around, put it somewhere else. So the Baal Shem Tov walked into the room and he said to me, "Did you move my slippers?" He said, "Yes." The Baal Shem Tov said, "Please don't move my slippers." Not because the Baal Shem Tov cared where his slippers were, because when the Baal Shem Tov put his slippers in a certain position, it's because it was synchronized with where slippers need to be according to the divine, the spiritual worlds. To us, it might sound like something small, but to like the Baal Shem Tov, who is a chariot for the divine, like the others, every little thing. He said, he blessed him. He said, "You should live a long life, but please don't move my slippers." So it was that person attributed his longevity to close, I think, to 100 years old, because the Baal Shem Tov said to him, "You should live a long life and don't move my slippers." So Yaakov, when he put his bed, he knew where he's putting his bed. Reuven messed with the bed, and now Yaakov brings it up. He doesn't really tell him much all these years. But now, before his passing, Yaakov tells him that this is what you've done, and therefore you're going to lose everything. In other words, you're the firstborn, you're the oldest. You should have merited, you should have had everything, and now you're getting nothing. Everything is taken away from him. Every quality, every position of leadership that Reuven was supposed to have, he was stripped from. Nothing. He's equal now to, almost equal to all the other brothers. And aside from that, Yaakov doesn't give him not even a little smile. Nothing. Next, Shimon and Levi step up, and Shimon and Levi are also treated very harshly by Yaakov. And he rebukes them. He comes close to even cursing them. Chas v'shalom, he doesn't say the curse to them, but he curses their wrath because of two things that they've done. He felt that they were involved in the selling of the whole thing against Yosef, that they were the main instigators, and also because of what they did in the city of Shechem without his permission. So he's very harsh with them. First three of the brothers. And suddenly Yaakov's mood changes. And when Yehuda steps up, Yaakov is happy, he's joyous, and he's heaping blessings on Yehuda galore. Yehuda's being blessed with the greatest of blessings. So first of all, you realize that the Shvatim must have been incredible great men. If this is their last meeting with their father, and their father was so tough with them, you have to say that they were real men. They were able to take a stinging rebuke from Yaakov, and they didn't rebel. They didn't walk out and say, "You know, I have nothing to do with this religion anymore." They took it, and they remained great tzaddikim and great men. But we see the change when it comes to all the other Shvatim, Yehuda, Yaakov, and then Yosef and Binyamin, and all of them. Yaakov is loading them with blessings, with beautiful words, with incredible gifts and presence that he gives each and every one of them, with such love and such affection. But not to Reuven, and not to Shimon, and not to Levi. So we need to understand this a little better. Why the harsh treatment to Reuven, particularly? I mean, okay, he glitched, he did something wrong, but why is he being treated so harshly? That's interesting. Rashi says, what did Reuven lose? What did Reuven lose as a consequence for the sin that he did? So Rashi says Reuven lost two things. He would have been the Kohen. The priesthood, the Kohuna, would have belonged to Reuven as the oldest one. Yaakov knows that, you know, not all of his descendants are going to be Kohanim. Kohanim is one family amongst the Jewish people. it can go to any of the children. If you, so naturally, who does it go to? To the oldest son, the one who's Bechor. He comes first before everything for any special treatment. So Reuven should have been the Kohen. Yaakov takes the Kahuna away from him. Who is it given to? It's given to Levi. It's not in our parsha. By us, it doesn't say that Yaakov gave it to Levi. But it just says he takes it away from Reuven. He says, Yeser Se'es, you should have been greater than your brothers. With Se'es, Se'es is with an added advantage. Rashi says the word Se'es comes from the word Nesias Kapayim. You should have been had the privilege to raise your hands up to bless the Jewish people. That's what Kohanim do. They bless the Jewish people. But because Pachas Kamayim, because you rushed like water, Al Toysar, you will not have that extra advantage. The other thing, Yeser Oiz, you should have been greater and exceeded your brother with Oz, with strength, with power. And that is referring to royalty. You should have been the king of the brothers. You should have had kingship. But I'm taking that away from you. Who was that given to? That was given to Yehuda. Yehuda is the eternal king of the Jewish people. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, Shlomo Melech, the Davidic lineage until Mashiach. And that is the blessings that Yaakov tells Yehuda actually in this parsha. Lo Yasser Shevet Mi Yehuda, the ruler will never go away from Yehuda. Mochaikit Mi Bein Raglov, he's going to be in government, in governing position. He gives him blessing after blessing. Okay, but this is the blessing he takes. It's one of the things, kingship he gives to Yehuda, takes it away from Reuven. The Targum says there's a third thing that has been taken away from him. And that is, the third thing he took away from him was the firstborn privilege. Bechor, being the Bechor, firstborn, has, aside for the other things that he should have gotten because he's the Bechor, there is the virtue itself or the privilege of firstborn. So the Mefarshim, so the Targum says, that too was taken away from him. Who was that given to? That was given to Yosef. Yosef is considered Bechor Shoyroi Hadar Lo, he's the Bechor. Rashi, for whatever reason, mentions only two things that were taken away from Yosef, from Reuven, only the first, the priesthood, and the Kahuna and Malchus, priesthood and royalty, kingship. He doesn't mention the firstborn rights that's included in Yaakov's rebuke to Reuven, I'm taking it away from you. Now, even though Rashi clearly is of the opinion that too was taken away from Reuven as a punishment for his sin, because you can't argue on that, there's an open pasuk in Divrei Hayamim where it says clearly that Yaakov took away Reuven's firstborn rights and he gave it to Yosef because of what Reuven sinned with moving of Yaakov's bed. It says it open and explicitly in a verse in Chronicles in Divrei Hayamim. I don't know which pasuk, but it says there, if you look at the beginning, it says that was taken away from him. Rashi himself, in two other places, mentions that Reuven forfeited the Bechorah. Rashi says earlier, before the Birchas Yaakov, that Yaakov gave Vaninas, he tells Yosef, Vaninasati Lecha, I have given you Shechem Echad, one portion, over your brothers. So the second pshat of Rashi, the second interpretation, what does that mean? He says, is that the tribes, there was one tribe that was going to be divided into two tribes, into two shvatim. And that was a greatness that not only that each tribe, each one of the shvatim, each one of the brothers is the father of one tribe. But one of the 12 tribes are going to become two tribes. It could have been, because Yaakov knew that there's going to be 12, but really 13 tribes, for whatever reason. But Yaakov goes and he gives, now it should have gone to Reuven. But this special gift was taken away from Reuven and it went to Yosef. So Yosef now has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And they are considered tribes. They get a separate, each one is their own individual lot of land or plot of a piece of land in Eretz Yisrael. There's Ephraim and Manasseh have their own chelek, which we don't find by all the other shvatim. This is what he took away from him. The question over here is, if that's the case, If Reuven lost all three privileges, three things, and as the Targum says, Bechorah, Kahuna, and Malchus, the firstborn, the priesthood, and the kingship, how come in the pasuk over here, according to Rashi, the firstborn privilege is not mentioned. It's not what Yaakov is talking about, even though it was taken away from him, but it's not mentioned over here in the blessings, in this rebuke. So we need to understand why. Why leave that out? That is quite significant, and that's a very big punishment. And if we talk about the other punishments that he got, how come this is not listed? Because definitely it was part of what was taken away from him. So why isn't it listed in the rebuke? Now, aside from that, here is really the big problem. Reuven forfeits everything. He loses everything. Who gets it? So we said earlier, Yaakov distributes it amongst the other sons. Yehuda gets kingship. Levi gets the kahuna. Yosef gets the Bechorah, gets the firstborn rights. Now, in our blessings, which Yaakov blesses the Shvatim, we don't find him giving the kahuna to Levi. That doesn't say over there. That only happens much later in Jewish history, when the Levium are the only ones who do not bow down, the Levium were the only ones who joined Moshe Rabbeinu. And none of them sinned in the golden calf, and they joined and campaigned for Moshe to eradicate all the sinners, all those who bow down to the Egel Azov, to the golden calf. That's when Moshe gives them the uniqueness of the kahuna is given to Levi. So we don't find it in the blessings, at least over here, that any special gifts are given to Levi. Yosef, the firstborn rights given to Yosef are also not mentioned in the blessings itself. They're mentioned earlier in the parasha, other places in the Torah. However, the royalty taken away from Reuven and is given to Yehuda, and that is discussed in the blessings. As we mentioned earlier, when Yaakov comes to Yehuda, suddenly there is a complete change of attitude. He is happy, he is joyous, he loves him, and he heaps blessings upon him. What does he tell him? He says, you're going to be, let's read what he says to Yehuda. He says, you are going to be praised by your brothers. Yatcha, your hand, ba'odaf avecha, is going to be in the necks of your enemies. Yishtach v'lecha b'nei avicha, the sons of your father, which means all the tribes are going to bow down to you. Gur Aryeh Yehuda, a young lion, a young cub. And then eventually you're going to turn into a mighty adult lion. Yehuda is Yehuda. And I'm giving you all the blessings. Lo yaseh shevet mi Yehuda, as we said earlier, you will have the rulership. At ki yavei shila, even in Mashiach's days, you will remain the ruler of the Jewish people. And then he speaks about the richness of Yehuda's land. The land is going to be so fertile that the grapes is going to be so much wine that the people are going to launder their clothing in wine, and their teeth are going to be white from milk. Blessings upon blessings, all for Yehuda. And he gives a reason. Why? What's so great about Yehuda? Why is he such a hero? Why does he deserve such special treatment? So he tells him, right at the beginning, he says, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, Yehuda is a lion. Three words, he says, the reason why he's giving him the blessings. Mitaref, because what I have accused you of being the one who devoured Yosef, I accused you, because Yaakov always had suspicion about the tribes that they killed him. And his suspicion was the greatest on Yehuda. And the reason we can probably assume, because Yehuda was the king, even before Yaakov blessed him with kingship, he already exhibited royal tendencies. We find that the brothers say to Yehuda later, had you stepped in and told us not to sell Yosef, we would have listened to you. No one else could have done it but you. So Yehuda was meant to be the ruler. So Yaakov felt that Yehuda must have been jealous of Yosef, who Yosef was claiming to be the ruler. So that hatred or that jealousy that they had against Yosef was probably burning in Yehuda's heart more than the other brothers. So Yaakov, for 22 years, had thoughts in the back of his mind that Yehuda, who's compared to a lion, could have been, he is the one who devoured Yosef like a lion devours prey. So he says, when I thought, Miteref, Taraf, Taref, Yosef, when I thought that Yosef was ripped apart, I thought it was you. But Bini Alisa, you have vindicated yourself. You have removed yourself from that. You did not do that. Because Yaakov now knows the story. And he says, not only didn't you kill him, but you are the one who saved Yosef's life. Because as we know the story just from a few weeks ago, Yosef was thrown into the pit, and there were snakes and scorpions in the pit, and he would not have survived for too long. And then Yehuda says to the brothers, Ma betza, what are we going to gain? Ki naharig es achinu, that we kill our brother, v'chasinu es damai, and we cover his blood. L'chuvenim kerenu li'yishme'elim, let us go and sell him to the Arabs. So he was the one who gave them that idea, and they pull Yosef out of the pit, and they sell him. So Yehuda is responsible. Not, I thought you were the murderer, and now I see that you didn't do that. Quite on the contrary, you saved his life. And my reunion with Yosef and the completion of the family and the little bit of joy that I had in my life is thanks to you. So therefore, he says, I take my hat off for you. For you, you're the greatest. And for that, he blesses him with the greatest blessing, with kingship. The second thing he says to Yehuda, he means to, with these words, Miteref, Rashi gives another interpretation, not another interpretation. Rashi says, in addition to that, Yaakov was alluding to something else. Another time that Yehuda did something very noble. And that is with the story of Tamar. Tamar was Yehuda's daughter, just brief the story. Tamar was Yehuda's daughter-in-law. She wanted, and her husband's died, she had married two of Yehuda's sons, her husband's died. She wanted very, very much to have children from Yehuda's to be a mother of the Yehuda's dynasty. So she was married to the sons, but when that didn't work, she went and she portrayed herself as a prostitute, and she seduced Yehuda into having relations with her. She became pregnant, and then Yehuda hears that his daughter, he doesn't know that this is his daughter-in-law, and then later when he finds out, he is the one presiding over the trial, because here she was, and it was considered, being that she was waiting, it was a brother that she needed to marry, she had in some ways the law of a married woman until she would be released from that, what's called Yibum. We're not going to get into that right now. So therefore, her punishment was, and being that she was a daughter of a Kohen, she wasn't, because her father was Shem, and Shem was at that time considered the Kohen of the world, her punishment would have been punishable by death. She would have been burnt, Srefa. And as she was going out to be executed, Tamar went and sends to Yehuda a message. She sends him a bag with a little post note. Watson, he opens the bag and he sees the little note, and she says, you should know that the one that I am pregnant to is the owner of these items. Those items were things that she said to Yehuda. This is Yehuda, she asked for payment for her services with Yehuda. She asked for payment. What does Yehuda go? Yehuda gave her, Yehuda didn't have what to pay her, so she said, give me a security, give me a deposit, something I can hold on to. So she asked for his signet, and for his staff, and for his garment. Yehuda gives it to her. So now she sends the bag to Yehuda, and she says, no one sees, no one even knows what's there. Yehuda can open it up and just throw it away in the garbage, no one knows, and be quiet about it. And this was a decisive moment in Yehuda. Yehuda, if he is going to say that, she wasn't engaged in just promiscuous znus, but it was from him, he would be embarrassing himself, a terrible embarrassment, would be very, very ashamed. Here he is, the great rabbi, and here is what he did. Yet Yehuda, at that very moment, admits, and he says two words, Tzatka mimeno, she is right, mimeno it was from me, mimeni it was from me. And this was a very, very big embarrassment. We can imagine what went on in all the tabloids talking about Yehuda and what happened. But Yehuda did this, and by doing that, he saved her life. He saved, they didn't kill her, not her, and her. She was pregnant at that time with two babies. So Yehuda had saved three lives. So Yaakov says, Miteref, you were at a moment where you could have killed three people, and you had to make a decision. Bini Olisa, you rose to the occasion. At that moment, at that decisive moment, you admitted and you embarrassed yourself to save another human being. And for that, I bless you with kingship. This is the reason why Yehuda gets the royal treatment literally. But here we got to ask a question. We're taking away this privilege of kingship. We took it away from Reuven. Who are we giving it to? We're giving it to Yehuda. Why? Because Yehuda, two times, he acted in a very special way. He saved Yosef's life, and he admitted, and he saved the lives of Tamar. And he admitted his guilt. He owned up to his actions. He admitted responsibility for something that he did. He acknowledged his fault. Okay? Now let's take a look a moment and see the very, very something. Reuven, who is the one that we're taking the kingship away from, Reuven did the exact same thing like Yehuda did. Not only did Reuven do these, have the same virtue and the same merits like Yehuda, but he has these very two merits in a much greater way than Yehuda. He excels in these two things, in two things, in trying to save Yosef and in admitting his own fault, his own sins, and taking responsibility for it. He does it even to a greater degree than his brother Yehuda. What do we see? Let's go to Mechiras Yosef. We all remember, the story is still fresh in our mind. What happens? The brothers are ready to pounce on Yosef and stick a knife in his chest. That's where they were holding. They're ready to kill him right then and there. What happens? Reuven steps up and Reuven says to the brothers, Loi nakenu nefesh, let's not kill a human being. Let's go, we'll throw him into the pit. And our hand should not be in him. And that's what happened. They were ready to kill him and they didn't kill him. They put him in the pit. Now, so Reuven rescued Yosef's life. He saved him from the brothers. Not only that, but Reuven's intentions were, let's think about it. Reuven's intentions were, what did he want? He didn't want to let Yosef die in the pit. He knew that he cannot stop the brothers from killing Yosef. He saw that they were so angry. At that moment, there was nothing that was going to stop them. He alone can't stand up against nine of his brothers or the eight of the brothers. So he figured out a plan. If we can only get Yosef into the pit, satisfy the brothers' anger, the brothers are going to leave. He's going to come back later, retrieve Yosef, fish him out of the pit, send him down a rope, pull him up, and return him to his father. This is not, we don't have to speculate. The Torah says clearly that that was Reuven's intentions. He didn't say it, but the Pasuk says that that was Reuven's intentions. That's why he did it. Okay, so he literally wants to bring Yosef back to his father's home. In the end, it doesn't work out. Because Reuven goes away, and the time he comes back, Yosef has already been sold. Okay. Now, let's compare that to Yehuda. Yehuda never intended to save Yosef's life. Yehuda did not intend Yehuda says, okay, Yehuda doesn't want to kill him, but he doesn't want to bring him back to his father. What does Yehuda say? Yehuda says, what are we going to gain by killing him? Let's sell him. So, okay, he didn't kill him, but he sold his brother as a slave. And what it really, in those days, selling someone as a slave was pretty much a death sentence. Almost like death. It was a living hell to be a slave. And that's what Yehuda does. So you compare Reuven to Yehuda. Reuven wants to rescue him and bring him back safely to his father's house. Yehuda goes and sells him as a slave. So which one is greater? Reuven or Yehuda? Reuven is far greater. More than that, we see later, as we mentioned earlier, the brothers say to Yehuda, had you told us not to sell him, we would have listened to you. Which means Yehuda did have the power to bring him back. Had you told us to take him back to our father's house, to you we would have listened. Yehuda had the ability to do that, and he didn't do that. Worse than that, even this that he doesn't kill him, listen to what Yehuda says. Why don't they kill him? He hates him so much, why didn't he kill him? You would think, oh man, he had a brotherly, brother compassion. He feels better. After all, it's his brother. No. He says, what kind of financial gain are we going to gain? Ma betza. We're not going to make any money on this. He's going to die over there. He's going to be good to be buried. What else? What's there's no profit. If we sell him, we'll make a couple of dollars. Oh, so it's worth it for us to sell him as a slave. We're not going to have him. He's going to have a life of misery. And we're going to have money. That's his calculation. So you have very, 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 very impure motives in Yehuda's action in saving Yosef's life. Yet, what do? We're celebrating Yehuda and we're making such a big deal about him. And Reuven, who did the very same act, the very same thing, We're taking away that, and that's not, okay, you want to reward Yehuda, reward Yehuda. But you're rewarding Yehuda with a gift that you're taking away, that really belonged to Reuven. You're taking it away from Reuven, the very one who outshined his brother in this very deed. Where's the fairness? This is so unfair. And Yaakov already messed up. Chas v'shalom, we can't say Yaakov messed up, but it's kind of not being fair to his children and showing favoritism to one over the other. And here he's doing it once again. I think Reuven is supposed to feel. Reuven doesn't get anything. He doesn't get a pat on the back. He doesn't get a chip, a little pinch on the cheek from Yaakov. Doesn't even get a smile. He gets beaten by Yaakov. And then let's take the second thing that happened. What was the second thing Yaakov praises Yehuda? He's praising Yehuda that he admitted, he owned up to his actions. He admitted it. It was embarrassing, and he admitted it. And Reuven didn't admit. Reuven also admitted. Reuven was also doing tshuva. Rashi says, where was Reuven when Yosef was sold? So Rashi says, Reuven was out in the forest, and he was wearing sack clothing, and he's crying. He's weeping, and he's crying, and he's fasting. Because of the sin that he did, he realized he did something wrong and he offended his father, and therefore he's doing tshuva. Now let's measure up Yehuda and Reuven in terms of the tshuva that they did. Yehuda does one thing. Yehuda admits it one time. He says two words. Tzadka, she's right, mimeni it was from me. After that, we don't see any more remorse. We don't see Yehuda in a sackcloth. We don't see Yehuda fasting. We don't see Yehuda becoming emaciated because of fasting. We don't see anything. Yehuda goes on and lives his life. At least the Torah doesn't tell us that Yehuda is involved in tearing the hair out of his head and doing tshuva for quite a sin. Okay? He was with a prostitute. Okay? And Yehuda, we don't find any more tshuva besides the fact that he admits it one time. What is Reuven doing? Reuven is involved in mortifications. He's fasting. He's crying. He's doing tshuva. Not only that, how long after Reuven's sin is Reuven doing this tshuva? Let's take a look. Yehuda admits it one time. He says, Tzadka mimeni, she's right. That's it. We don't hear anything else about it. Reuven, the story of Mechiras Yosef happened 9 years after Reuven's sin. Okay, now we mess up from time to time. And we feel very good when we feel guilt about it. Oh, the tshuva. If we shed a tear, we feel really good. If we shed 3 tears, then we're mamash a tzaddik. We're not only a tzaddik, we're a baal tshuva as well. And a baal tshuva is higher than a tzaddik. So we feel bad maybe the next day, maybe 2 days, maybe on Shabbos we're a little bit uncomfortable with the sin that we did during the week. If we remember it till Erev Rosh Chodesh, which is called the Yom Kippur Katan, wow. And Yom Kippur, by then forget it. You did your tshuva on Yom Kippur, it's over. Reuven sinned, let's make the calculation. Why? When Yosef was born, Yaakov says to Lavan, I want to leave. Lavan says, I want to pay you back. We mentioned this 2 weeks ago. Yaakov decides to stay another 6 years and working with the sheep. So when Yaakov leaves Lavan's house and goes back to the land of Israel, Yosef is 6 years old. Okay? Yaakov spends 2 years on the road. At the end of the 2 years, his wife Rachel dies. At the end of the 2 years, Yosef is 8 years old then. What happens at that time? That's when the story with Reuven happened. Reuven moves the bed immediately after Rachel died. So Reuven's sin is when Yosef is 8 years old. When Yosef is sold as a slave, he is 17 years old. The Pasuk says clearly 17 years old. That means it happened 9 years later. It's almost a decade later, and Reuven is still busy doing tshuva. A real tshuva. He's spending the whole day fasting, saying tilim, soaking his tehillim with his tears, crying for the avera that he did. Talk about owning up to an action. And Yehuda says two words, Tzadka mimeni, she is right, it was from me. And what do? We clap, we applaud, we're singing Yehuda's praises, we're giving him kingship, and we take it away from Reuven. And more, let's take one more thing. What motivated Yehuda to do that? See, Yehuda has not have too much choice. If he ever can live with himself ever again, he better admit it right now. Because he's going to have to live with on his conscience. 3 people are put to death, and he knows that he is the one who really did it, and he knows she's innocent. And he's going to have to live with the death of three, I mean, at least one person, a mother, a pregnant mother, I don't know if you knew she had twins, at least two people, but in our case it was three people, he would have to live with this. So of course he had very little choice but to admit. I mean, had he been a wicked person, he would not have done it. But being that he was Yehuda, of course, he's one of the Shvatim, and he can't live with that, so he admits. Reuven didn't have something compelling him to admit. Reuven had every excuse in the world to say that he did a good thing. He was sticking up for his mother's honor. Reuven doesn't have a pleasure in moving beds around. That's not what his life is. What he likes doing for when he has free time. He's doing it because he feels bad for his mother. It hurts him. So for her honor, he gets, and the Gemara Taka says that Reuven didn't sin. Rashi says that's why a minute afterwards the Torah includes, so Reuven didn't sin, and he has, and yet for that whatever slight something that might have been that he acted a little bit in haste, whatever he did that wasn't good, he's doing tshuva. 9 years later, he's still weeping and crying and soaking his pillow in tears. And what? And Reuven, nothing. And Yehuda, tzadka mimeno, she's right. And he's rewarded with kingship. For him, for his children, for his grandchildren, forever and ever and ever. This is very puzzling, and we need a good answer. There is a unbelievable, genius explanation by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which is, the genius over here is not the genius of the mind. It's a genius of the soul. It's a genius of sensitivity. It's a genius of the heart. And he says, let's take a really analyze what's going on over here, and let's see. What really is the difference between Yehuda and Reuven? You see, there are three qualities that we spoke about before that Reuven should have been superior than the brothers. He should have been greater than the brothers in three things. He should have been the firstborn. He should have had the firstborn rights. He should have been king, and he should have also been the Kohen. Okay, all three were taken away from him. Two of them are mentioned here. One of them, we said, is not mentioned here, the firstborn, but it was also taken away from him. There's a difference between the first and the latter two. The first one is Bechora, and the other two are kingship and priesthood. See, kingship is a quality that relates to one's interpersonal relationship. Kingship is something that is a position which one holds in regards to other people. You have sovereignty over who? You're governing over a people. You're in charge over a people. So it's your relationship with others. Right? The melech, and we know the phrase, ein melech b'lo am. There is no king without a people. There's nothing to kingship if you're alone on an island and there's no other human being there. There's nothing to being a king. It doesn't have any significance whatsoever. The entire kingship is in the relationship. Priesthood, kahuna, is also relationship. Because a kohen wasn't a kohen for himself. A kohen wasn't a tzaddik who's shuckling in the Beis HaMikdash and getting very close to God. Kohanim were the agents of the people to serve as the mediators between Hashem and the Jewish people. They're offering up their korbanos. And their job mainly, what kohanim are really all about, is to bring down the divine blessing. That's really what it's all about. They're here to help channel, to help facilitate and draw down God's blessings to the people. Everything else that they do, they're bringing karbanos, and they're offering sacrifices, and doing all the officiating in the temple, everything else, that was all an introduction. And was by helping the people come close, is the kohanim were able to draw down Hashem's blessings, the bracha, to the people. So again, it's about relationship. They're also teachers. They're also the counselors, the teachers of the people. That's why we find that it says that when you have a mishpat, when you have a judge, when you have an issue, a question in Torah law, ubasa la kohanim, you should come to the kohanim hashayir bayamim hahem. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he benches Shevet Levi, he says, yoru mishpatecha liYaakov. They're the ones who teach your laws to Yaakov. The kohanim were the rabbis amongst the people. So again, it's also a relationship. So kingship and kahuna, the quality, its main aspect, it's all about how you relate to others. Bechora, firstborn quality, is something which is related to a person's private self, to who you are. You're the firstborn. And therefore, you have firstborn rights. And what are the firstborn rights? You get double portion in the father's property. Double portion. What is that? That has nothing to do with people. You're getting you're getting more of the father, father's wealth, whatever. No one gains from that. No one. It's your own personal quality, personal achievement that a bechor has. So that's the difference. Bechorah is one's own self. Kahuna and malchus, priesthood and kingship, is relationship to others. When Reuven lost because of his sin, he lost all three. It's because included in Reuven's sin, there is a double sin. There is a double blemish in Reuven's sin. There is one part in Reuven's sin which is unrelated to anybody else. It's his own personal fault. It's his own blemish on his own, in his own character. Something wrong with him as a human being, unrelated to other people. It was, we'll see soon what that is. As a result of that, Reuven forfeited something that was related to him. Instead of him being the Bechor, he is not the Bechor anymore. Because again, Bechorah shows. If you're the firstborn, so then you have a higher soul, so to speak. You have more of the Father's power in your soul. And therefore, you deserve to have this greater blessing given to you. These personal gifts that make you a better person, whether physically or spiritually, make you a better person. Reuven, because he showed a lack of that supreme power of Bechorah, there was a fault in his own self, in his personal life. Because of that, he forfeited this extra gift that would have enhanced, embellished him as a person. Okay. There's another part to Reuven's sin, and that is that how it affected other people. He had an effect on others. His bad choice had an effect on other people, harmed others. Because it harmed others, for that reason, his kahuna and malchus, priesthood and kingship, is taken away from him, because of these are things which a person is, it's qualities and positions in relationship to others. And when he showed a weakness in his leadership quality of affecting other people, he lost that ability, or he showed that he's not worthy for it, and therefore we can't give it to him. Let's take a look at Reuven's sin and see where we see both things. The first thing is that Reuven had a misjudgment. He was presumptuous. He's watching what happened. He concludes that if my father dies, his bed really belongs not in, should not be anymore, shouldn't be in Bilhah's, it should be by Leah. That's the way. That was his conclusion based on his calculations. Now he acted upon that, which means he thought he's right. What should he have done? He said, probably my father is smarter than me. If he does it this way, he probably knows what's best. If it would have bothered him very, very much, he should have sat down with his father, had tea with him, and discussed it. Say, you know what, I'm a little bothered by this. Maybe you can tell me why you're doing this. And Yaakov would have told him, and Reuven would have accepted. He was presumptuous, and he decided that he was correct. And that's a flaw in his judgment. That's personal. He misjudged. Okay. You're the Bechor. You should get things right. You got it wrong. It was taken away from him. Now the truth is, this is a very small blemish. Because Bechorah wasn't really taken away from Reuven completely. It was, Rashi says, it was only taken away in regards to the division of the two tribes. That one tribe becomes two, that was given to Yosef. But Reuven's personal Bechorah, that he gets his father's possession, a double portion, who got, if Yaakov had 12 Kiddush, 13 Kiddush cups, who got two Kiddush cups of Yaakov? Reuven got it. Who got the double portion in Yaakov's, Reuven got twice as much as all the other tribes, because it wasn't taken away from him completely. The reason is because it was a very subtle sin. It was a misjudgment, but it came from a good place. He's standing up for his mother. It's not coming from something negative or something wrong, but still, there was a blemish. So there's a consequence for the blemish. Bechorah is taken away from him. But the main problem in Reuven's work wasn't, in Reuven's misdeed wasn't his own misjudgment. The main problem was he got angry and he acted because he felt hurt. Okay, he feels hurt for his mother. And because of that, he goes ahead and he does an act that is offensive to another person. In his haste, in his swiftness, he hurts his father. He hurt his father. He says, what you're doing isn't right. And he goes in and he demonstrates. He's protesting against his father. Moves Yaakov's bed. He hurt Yaakov. And it had spiritual consequences because the Shekhinah went away from Yaakov's bed. I don't know what it takes to get the Shekhinah back down. I don't know if it's just moving the bed back. You see, from what Yaakov says, you desecrated the Shekhinah that goes on my bed. Which means he brought a very bad effect. He hurt Yaakov very deeply. So you hurt another person. Why? Because you were too busy with yourself. You were too busy with your pain, how you're feeling. Yes, feeling about your mother, that's true. But you're feeling hurt. And because of that, you're insensitive to another person. To be a leader, to be a king, your own feelings can never come before someone else. The leader's entire business is to feel, to have his fingers on the pulse of the people, to feel the people deeply, and to feel the people more than himself. A leader can never ever put his own benefit before his people. And therefore, when you did that and you hurt your father because of your haste, even though it was a moment. But a leader cannot have a moment like that. A leader can't even have one moment where he forgets who he is as a leader, because the entire community, the entire people are dependent on him. He has a moment where he puts himself, his life, his well-being before his flock, before his people. Finished. He can't be the ruler. He can't be the king. Both. Kingship was taken away from him and kahuna, because both of them are leadership in which the leader has to be very sensitive to the feelings, to the needs of his people. And here we're going to see an amazing thing, and that's why it's interesting. When Yaakov is rebuking Reuven, again, you see from the words that Yaakov uses that he's not talking about the sin itself. He's talking about the haste like water that you rushed. You rushed without, you lost yourself for a moment, and you put yourself before someone else, and you hurt me. I mean, Yaakov wasn't talking about so much of that, it was hurting me, but you hurt your father. He's not talking about the sin itself. What you did maybe is not as bad, but the fact that you cannot be a leader. That's why Rashi doesn't talk about, that's why the Pasuk over here doesn't talk about the third quality of Bechorah, because that wasn't such a blemish. The main blemish over here is, which is spoken of when Yaakov is giving the blessings, is not the personal flaw, but the flaw that relates to others, to his relationship with others. And now let's take a look and we can and examine both Yehuda and Yosef from this perspective and see how their actions materialized in regards to other people. You see, when Reuven says to the brothers, let's not kill Yosef. Let's not kill him. Let's put him in the pit. Reuven had very, very good intentions. Wonderful intentions. He wanted to really do something nice. His intent was virtuous, was clean. He wanted nothing more than seeing Yosef back happily, safely in the hands of his father. That's what he wanted. Bottom line, let's not look at Reuven for a moment. Let's look at the consequence of Reuven's actions in regards to someone else. On Yosef's end. On Yosef's end, what happened from Reuven? Okay, they didn't kill him. They threw him in a pit. The pit was filled with snakes and scorpions. Was Yosef in any better position after Reuven saved him from the brothers and put him in the pit? Now, it could be Reuven doesn't know that there are snakes and scorpions in the pit. It's possible. And I'm sure Reuven has all the argument to say, how am I supposed to know that there were snakes and scorpions? That's irrelevant. It's irrelevant if you knew. Doesn't make a difference if you knew or you didn't know. Bottom line, you your intervention, did it do anything? You showed what a good tzaddik you are, how nice and how kind and how virtuous you are. But to Yosef, did his situation improve after your intervention? Nothing at all. He put him from one danger into another danger. And then he went away to do tshuva. Okay? Let's take a look at Yehuda. Yehuda is acting very greedy. He's thinking, their brother is in a pit dying. And Yosef is crying and screaming and pleading and begging and yelling to the brothers, help, please, how can you do this to me? You hear? And Yehuda is yelling to Yosef, to the brothers. Yehuda at that moment is thinking about profit. He can make a couple of dollars. He's going to sell Yosef as a slave. Couldn't have any uglier intentions. Bottom line, he steps in and he says, let's sell him. Why are we going to kill him? What are we going to gain? Let's sell him. They take Yosef out. They sell him as a slave. Yosef becomes a king. He's a ruler over the world. And Yosef is reunited with his family and the rest is happily ever after. Why? Because of what Yehuda did. Yehuda's action, bottom, at the very end, brought salvation and benefited Yosef and it saved his life. He, not so good, not so wonderful, can't come close to Reuven's purity of motive. But here you have good motives. And here you have someone who actually rescued Yosef from the pit. So it depends where we're looking from. If we're looking at one's intentions, what you wanted, all very good. But a leader can't make mistakes. And the thing about the leader is not his purity of motives. If you're a leader, you have charge over the people. And the people come before you. And ultimately, every choice you make needs to affect the people. And affect the people for the good. And if the choices that you're making are not benefiting the people, you'd have no business being a king. But Yehuda could be the king. Because his action saved Yosef, saved a life. Let's continue. What's the next story that happened? Yehuda's with Tamar. Yehuda says to the brother, Yehuda admits when they bring the bag in front of him, he admits. And he says, Satka Memene, she's right, it's from me. Very, very bare minimal admitting. As we said earlier, it doesn't do nothing more than just admitting briefly. What happened as a result of him saying those two words? One thing. Tamar was on her way to be thrown into a fire. And what happened? He saved her life. Tamar did not die, not she and not her children. Her life, he saved her life. When it came, let's go take a look at Reuven. Reuven is doing tshuva. He's crying and he's doing tshuva and he's repairing. Did anybody benefit from this tshuva? Did anybody in the world, of course, Reuven is receiving, deepening his connection to Hashem. He's cleansing his soul. He's washing his soul. He's scrubbing his soul. And it might not be clean enough, so he's going deeper and deeper and cleaning. But did the world get any benefit? Did any human being aside Reuven benefit from this? Did the good come out to the people? Nothing. Nothing at all. We can even argue. Had Reuven not been so busy doing tshuva, and when your brother is in a pit, he would not leave, if he wouldn't have gone off to go and cry and be busy with his own purification, and he would have stood nearby watching Yosef so that he could take him out of the pit, then it's quite arguably that Yosef would have never have been sold as a slave, because Reuven would have stopped it from happening, because he wasn't going to let him be. Yeah? He wanted to take him out. So first he did whatever he can, but had they been ready to make something like this, he would have interfered, maybe even risked his life. But he didn't. Why? Because he was busy doing tshuva. Now he's doing a very great tshuva. This is very, very great for him. But bottom line, is someone in the world helped by this tshuva? No. His overly involvement with himself, that he's so busy being a tzaddik and being good, that another person's life is in danger. He's compromising the life of another human being because he's too much involved in himself. That's wonderful. You're a tzaddik, you're going to go to Gan Eden, you're going to get a huge portion in Olam Haba, but a leader of a people you cannot be. Because if you can abandon another person and be busy with your own achievements and your own accomplishments on the expense of another person, you can't be a leader. The leader is the people. The people must always come before. When it says the Rambam describes a melech, the Rambam says, what is a king? The Rambam describes a king is called Lev Ha'am. He is the heart of the people. It's interesting. Now, the heart, we know, is a central organ. It is the most one of the most powerful organs in the body, vital to life. So we understand the king is compared to the heart. But shouldn't we compare the king to the brain? The brain, if this, you're talking about the supreme organ in the human being, the supreme is the brain. The king is the one who has to teach. He's the one who guides and teaches. But the king is the one who has to make decisions. He has to direct the people, decide the right, make the laws of the land. So you need, of course, you need someone with brains. So the king would be the Rosh, he would be the Mochen, the brains of the people. Yet the king is not compared to the brain, he's compared to the heart. What's the difference between the heart, the physical difference between the heart and the brain? The heart, both again, both heart and brain have influence on the body, continuous. And the body cannot function with any of these two, with either of them missing or not functioning, then the person can't live. So both of them, we require the effects of both the heart and the brain for a healthy, for a person to live. But there's a difference in the manner of the relationship. Two things. Number one, the heart is always pumping. The heart is always pumping. The heart doesn't stop for a moment. The heart is in a state of excitement. It's excited all the time. And we see excitement. Because when you get excited about something, the heart starts racing quicker. So the heart is in a perpetual state of excitement. The mind, the brain is very calm. Calm. Generally, the mind is what, when you introduce your mind into a situation, it brings calmness. The heart, generally associated with emotion, excitement. Why is the heart? Another thing the Zohar says, the difference between the heart and the brain. The Zohar says that the heart is the softest, the Zohar says it is the rachich, softest of all parts of the body. Yes, the heart doesn't have a bone. Even though the heart is a powerful muscle, it's pumping a lot of blood. How many times a minute? Non-stop. Right? Baruch Hashem, she will have a healthy heart. The heart doesn't stop. But the heart, the Zohar says, I don't know what the Zohar means in the physical element of it, but the Zohar says the heart is the softest, the weakest, he says, of all limbs. The brain doesn't say that about the brain. These two things, that the brain is calm and the heart is active the whole time, that the brain is not the weakest, but the heart is the weakest, tells us something about the difference between them, fundamentally in their relationship with the body, in giving life to the organs. You see, the heart has no other business. Its entire identity, its entire being is one thing: to support all other limbs. The heart doesn't do anything else but enabling all the other limbs to work, because everybody needs blood. Blood is the life force of the person, and the heart is supplying blood. Besides from that, the heart has no personal identity. It has no self. It has no... See, every limb has something that it does. Every limb contributes to the ultimate well-being of the body, right? The hands contribute, the feet, but the hands do what hands do. Feet do what feet do. And the liver does what the liver does. The kidney does what the kidney does. Each limb has a function. This one helps in digestion. This one helps in purifying the blood. Each one has a function for itself. The heart isn't doing anything but enabling everybody else to work. So it's a servant of all the limbs. That's what it is. A servant of the limbs. Nothing to itself. That's why the heart is always excited. Because it is always working. It is always serving. It has no minute. It has no vacation. It has no moment for itself. Because it has no self. And that's why the heart is also the weakest. As we said earlier, the Zohar says, the weakest of all of the limbs. Because when you have, the heart is a nobody. He has no, he's weak. Because there's nothing to the heart. You're a somebody. Oh, that's your strength. But he's a nobody. His being is that he's a servant of them all. The brain influences the entire body. But the brain is cool about it because the brain influences the body from a distance. It's outside, it's above. And the brain has an identity of its own. The brain is busy. It has what it is all about. The brain is all about conceiving, understanding, ideas, knowing. Now, one of the functions of the brain is to control the rest of the body. It does that too, but it does it from a distance. That's why it sits on the top in its own compartment. There's a little hose connecting the brain to the rest of the body. And from up there, from its calm, withdrawn, uninvolved, so to speak, state, it directs what's going on in the body, but not so the heart. The heart is the limbs are the heart. And that's why the king is called the heart of the people, because a king is a servant of the people. The king has no identity. His entire existence and his entire being, of course, we're talking about a true, noble, real king, not a tyrant. But a real king is, he's here to serve. The Pasuk says, you should have a melech asher yotzeim, that brings them out, v'asher yoviem, and that brings them in. Aside from that, the king has nothing to do. So there's no moment in the king's life where it's his personal life, this is my time. The king has no time, that's why it's another thing. We said earlier that the heart is the weakest of all limbs. The king is the weakest in the entire country. Because every single person in the country, every single person has some way of supporting himself. His own way of making a living. On a malchus, we say, in the attribute of malchus, we say, leisle megar meklum, it doesn't have anything of its own. The king gets everything from the people. Everything, every piece of bread that he gets. He's the wealthiest of everyone. He's the most powerful of the entire country, but he's the weakest because he doesn't have anything unless everybody, only from what the people give him. Now it's interesting. You see, clergy, any clergyman or other people in positions of are supported by the company, by the community. But there is a difference, even in tax laws. There's a difference that if you're a clergyman, you have certain things that we can say the community is responsible for. You don't have to pay taxes. You don't have to pay for residence, for living costs, for this cost, or for that cost, because we're responsible for you. But the clergyman can't claim that everything they're responsible for him, everything. There is part, they call it parsonage. Part of what you need for a living, others are responsible for. But why? Because a clergyman has an identity, has a self. One of the things he needs to do is also care for the people. The king, the people have to give everything to. There's nothing that the king is responsible. Okay, no, this you have to get. For your basic breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you got to take care of yourself. We'll have other things. You need to have an army. We'll give you an army. You need to have this or that. We'll give you that. No. Every single thing is given to the king. Why? Because the king has no identity. Because his entire being is the servant of the people. He makes them all move. He gives them their energy. He directs them. He guides them. He inspires them. He's the lifeblood of the people. He is identityless. Therefore, the king cannot have a moment of self. And God forbid to claim that his own personal whatever, well-being comes before the people. That's not a king. He loses it instantly because he's the heart of the people. And that's what happens over here with Yehuda. Yehuda is, or the difference between Yehuda and Reuven. Yehuda's actions, again, whether he was pure, whether he was holy, whether it was good, maybe not that good. There's a lot to question Yehuda's integrity and Yehuda's morality. I'm sure he was a big tzaddik, let's not make a mistake. But at least in terms of, in comparison to Reuven, maybe not so perfect, but he is displaying leadership quality. Wherever he steps in, the people around him benefit. But that's not by Reuven. Reuven is a big tzaddik, wonderful, but his involvement doesn't bring benefit to others. Quite on the contrary, he harmed a few people. He left quite a mess in the people around him and the things that he was doing. Even though, on a personal level, he was always trying the best and always trying to do the best thing possible and in a refined way and in a good way, but it didn't have those consequences. So someone once came to the Balatanya, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and he complained that when he's giving tzedakah, he feels very bad. He feels very bad about the tzedakah that he's giving. Why? Because he feels that he gives it for ulterior motives. it's not being done in truth. He's not doing it with emes. Because he's thinking, you know what, I'm doing it. I want people to say, I'm a good guy. I'm nice, I'm kind. I want to have a good name. I want people should do a shidduch with me for my children or whatever. All these other things that I'm doing, it's not pure. And he's crying, he's bemoaning to the Rebbe. He says, I want to do a mitzvah with a purity. And the Rebbe said to him, but the poor man who was hungry, he is not hungry anymore with an emes. He's truthfully not hungry. The person who was sick and needed medications has now been relieved from his pain in a very true way. So even if your motives maybe were not so pure and so clean, and so pure, but the goodness that you brought to other people, that is true, and that's what counts. That's what counts. Sometimes we get so caught up in trying to be good that we completely forget our obligations that we have to other people and our obligations that we have to the world. Here's another very beautiful story, also with the Baal HaTanya, that one time he was sitting, he lived in a house and he lived upstairs, and his son, known later as Reb Dov Ber, the Mittler Rebbe, lived downstairs. And the son had a little baby, a little child sitting in the crib. And the Rebbe, the son was, the Mittler Rebbe was in a deep trance. He was a very big Baal Mochin. He had a great, incredible mind. And he would get into deep meditations. And sometimes he can be in a trance for an hour, for a very long time. And one time, in the midst of this trance, the child fell out of the crib. There was a little shelf or something, fell down, and the child was crying and crying and crying. But he didn't hear. He literally didn't hear because he was so deeply involved in his deep machshav and his deep meditation. His father, Reb Shneur Zalman, who was upstairs, was also learning and deeply involved in what he was learning. But he hears the baby cry. He comes downstairs, picks up his grandchild, and is calming the baby down, and finally puts the baby and goes back upstairs. His son didn't notice at all that his father came down and picked up because he was so deeply involved in his meditation. Later, his father, the Baal HaTanya, says to his son, the Mittler Rebbe, he says to him, you should know that a Jew is never, ever allowed to get so deeply immersed in his own spiritual pursuits to the point when he doesn't hear the cry of another Jewish child. God forbid, to chas v'shalom be so involved. It could be the most noble of things. You're experiencing divine unity. You're experiencing the oneness of God in all the cosmos, and you're melting in love of Hashem in the deepest ecstasy. But there's a person that needs help and that is crying, and you're so deeply involved because you can't hear the cry from another. That's not the way. That's not holiness, but it's not the ultimate. A yid has to have more important than us achieving, reaching perfection, purification, is our main cheshben hanefesh has to be. I'm going to sleep tonight. How many people benefited from me? How many people benefited from me? We have people sometimes that do so much good for the community, so much good. They're kind, they give money, and people like to dismiss it. Oh, they're giving up, they're doing it for fame, for a name, for this. Yeah, but from those people, hungry people are fed. Schools are built, and all kinds of goodness comes. So what? Intentions. Intentions are nice. Sometimes it's not the thought that counts. Sometimes it's the consequence and the action, the bottom line what counts. And if the motives are not so pure, okay. But you did good for the world, and others benefited. And that's more important. And here you have, take a look at the conclusion of the story. You see Yehuda, Reuven goes off and he's scrubbing his neshama, clean, clean, clean. He goes away. Because he's so deeply involved in himself, what happens? Yosef is sold as a slave. And when Yosef is sold as a slave, that begins the exile. And the exile of Egypt is the source of all exiles. You hear? The result of a person deeply into his own rectification at the expense of someone else brings about, chas v'shalom, the Jewish people coming into exile. Yehuda, who is acting not for the necessarily on the highest level, yet says tzot kamimene at that moment, and he saves three lives. He fathers Mashiach. He brings redemption to the world. So over obsession with oneself, even if it's for holiness and for good purposes, brings exile. And what brings geula, what brings redemption? Goodness to other people. Even if it might, maybe you could have been more involved in yourself and reached higher, purer states. That's not Mashiach. And the reason is simple. Because exile means to be in limitation. Mitzrayim especially. Mitzrayim means limitation. If you're into yourself, no matter how much and how good and how wonderful you reach, after everything is said and done, you're still you. You're still finite. And that's exile. Exile is limitation and boundaries. When you go out of yourself and you help and you hear and you sense and you feel another person and you do a good for another human being, then you broke out of the limitations and the boundaries of self, and then you touch the divine. And that's redemption. So right before Mashiach comes, especially now, at the end of days, we have to think more about doing good, not so much about being good. We need to do good as much as we can do. Have our sensitivity, hear, sense, feel other people, and that needs to be our main occupation. We all do that, we will have geula, mamish now. Yeah.